couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films First Man, Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, Bad Times at the El Royale, and Colette. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring Skyscraper. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Only a couple pieces of news that I really wanted to focus on this week, and the first one is about James Gunn. Now, of course, if you remember earlier this year, he was unceremoniously fired by Disney as the director of Guardians of the Galaxy 3, even though he had already worked on a script and they were in pre-production, and it was because of these old tweets, and they were offensive tweets, but there were tweets that he sent out as they were bad taste jokes, but they were jokes. They were not real tweets of real things he did. And it was kind of a hit piece because this was picked up by like a conservative blogger who was, I think he was angry at the fact that James Gunn was very critical of President Trump and his policies. And that's his own right to do that. But this guy then kind of created this outrage out of nowhere and had people say, oh, how dare you, hire this guy because he's directing a movie for kids. It's about a talking raccoon in a tree. And isn't this terrible that you're letting this person make jokes about pedophilia and rape and you're going to keep him on the project? And people overreacted. People went after him, and then Disney knee-jerk fired him, which I thought was a huge mistake by Disney, mainly because this was behavior that took place almost 10 years ago before he was even affiliated with Disney. He has not done it since. This is not something he was doing like this weekend. It was something he had done in his past, and he has grown as a director, and he had apologized for it, and he'd actually brought it up back when he was hired for Guardians of the Galaxy 1, 5-6 years ago. But because we live in an outrage culture where everybody wants to knee-jerk and get offended at everything, people are weaponizing outrage. That's not a good thing. I feel for James Gunn. I don't think he should have been fired for that. Yes, it was in bad taste, but he apologized and he changed his behavior. It's not like he denied it and deleted it and then said it didn't exist. He acknowledged it. He owned up to it. He changed his behavior, and he's not doing that anymore. And it was just jokes in the first place. This is the industry that lets Mike Tyson star in movies, a convicted rapist. Yet James Gunn, who makes some bad taste, and yes, they're in bad taste. And I was hoping that Disney would quietly rehire him, but I think a lot of eyes are on him, and I think they're waiting for a little bit to try and do that. But they may not have a chance, because rumor has it that Warner Brothers is eyeing James Gunn to write and direct Suicide Squad 2. Now, if you remember Suicide Squad, it was a Warner Brothers film about DC comic antiheroes, people like Deadshot and the Joker and Harley Quinn, all these people from Arkham Asylum who are put into the mix to try and stop other bad guys who are worse than them. The first Suicide Squad was awful. The only good thing about it was Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn. But outside of that, it's a terrible movie. It did extremely well, but I think that was an aberration. I really don't think that that movie would have done as well as it did had it come out any other time but that. I think a lot of it falls on the shoulders of David Ayers, who I think is an overrated director and too grim and gritty and depressing of a director. Anyways, he was going to do the original sequel, and then he dropped out of it, and they had somebody else. But now they're looking at James Gunn, and I'm like, that would be great. In fact, that would breathe life into the Warner Brothers brand. You know, right now, all you've got is Wonder Woman as a big success. So the Batman and the Superman stuff has been stumbling. You got Aquaman that may or may not be good. We'll see what happens at Christmas. But James Gunn has shown he can do quirky, weird, out-of-the-box superhero movies. I think it would be a big win. For James Gunn, it would be a big win for Warner Brothers because it could help revitalize the brand. Because I don't think that... I think what made your first Suicide Squad do better was Will Smith more than David Ayers. But if you put a really good director behind it, someone who really has a finger on the pulse of pop culture, yeah, James Gunn could really make this thing work. The next piece of news I want to talk about is there's been more rumors about a new streaming service out there. Warner Brothers is wanting to start its own streaming service. And here's where I'm saying, okay, people, let's not get out of hand, because everyone's like, cut the cable. You don't need to have cable anymore. You can just stream your content. The problem is right now, everyone's wanting to go to streaming. Everyone's want to bypass cable, but nobody wants to diversify their rights. And that's going to be a problem, because nobody's going to want to buy $10 a month for Netflix, $10 a month for Amazon Prime, $10 a month for Hulu, $10 a month for HBO, $10 a month for CBS to see Star Trek. No one's going to want to then spend $10 a month for Warner's, for Disney. You actually saw this happen in basic cable back in the 80s when they brought out the Disney Channel. It used to be a premium service, and then it ended up just becoming part of the basic cable dial. And I think that's what's eventually going to happen with these streaming services. What you're going to end up with is you're going to end up with someone they're going to figure out to do a consolidated streaming service that can draw from all of them and give rights back and forth. And you're going to end up with another cable company, only it's not going to be cable, it's going to be streaming. It's going to be a consolidated service, because no one's going to want to carry 15 different subscriptions a month. They'd rather say, fine, I'll pay $50 a month and I want all of it. So that's what we're going to get to. It just may take 10 or 15 years to get there. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is The Mule, opening on December 14th.
I didn't deserve forgiveness. This is the last one. So help me God. This is the last one. For what it's worth, I'm sorry for everything.
This one stars and is directed by Clint Eastwood, who wasn't he supposed to retire like 5 years ago? What was his last movie where he starred in? I forget which one that was. And he said, okay, I'm not going to star in movies anymore, but he continued to make movies. And, you know, he just did 15, 17 to Paris earlier this year, and he did Sully last year. You know, he's done some great stuff, but he keeps doing the Cher farewell tour. And now he's starring in another movie, which is fine. I mean, good for him. You know, work until you keel over, man. That's great. And I think he blows hot and cold for me. I think some of his movies are great and some aren't. This one is still up in the air. This could be a good one. It could not be. Generally, when he's in it, he's pretty good in his own movies. It's when he doesn't cast himself. But even then again, Sully, I thought was a fantastic film, and he didn't star in that. But this looks like it's Gran Torino on the road. So I don't know. This one looks very Clint Eastwood. This is one I'm going to have to see before I actually get any sort of excitement about it, I guess. The next one I want to talk about is Pet Sematary, the remake, which opens on April 5th of next year.
Maybe just some crazy folk tale, but there is something up in those woods. Something that brings things back. Sometimes dead is better.
I gotta say, there's elements of this trailer I think that are cool. I like some of the actors and some of the look of the film. But there's other parts that I don't think are nearly as good. You've got John Lithgow in there, who was played by Fred Gwynne in the original. Now, of course, Fred Gwynne's dead. But Fred Gwynne just so embodied that character, and he had that main accent, you know, where he's like, oh, come on up over here, and we're gonna talk about this. Man, sometimes dead is better. I know I have a terrible Maine accent. My apologies to everybody in Maine. But John Lithgow, as much as I love John Lithgow, I don't think he embodies the role that was in the book. The other thing is it has this weird little kids walking around with masks that seems to be playing off of You're Next and also playing off of The Wicker Man. And I'm like, just go back to the original book. The book's a great book. And it looks like a lot of things are going to hit the right beats. But I don't know. I mean, this one's not jazzing me. But then again, I thought the original was actually pretty spot on, the one that Mary Lambert did in the 80s. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about First Man, including a review of the film, plus the stupid controversy that went along with it leading up to it. We'll be right back. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with our first movie, First Man. I'm going to start off by reviewing it. But then I want to address the controversy that came earlier this year, and I didn't bury the lead very well with my complaint already last segment, but you'll understand why I say it's a stupid controversy. And this goes back to sort of the weaponizing outrage for dumb reasons. But anyway, let's talk about the movie first. Let's get that out of the way, because I think let's talk about the movie as clean as possible, and that is First Man. Oscar-winning director Damien Chazelle takes this very intimate look at a Neil Armstrong biopic.
First man to walk on the moon. That'd be something.
We've chosen a job so difficult, requiring so many technological developments. We're going to have to start from scratch.
Neil, if this flight is successful, you'll go down in history. What kind of thoughts do you have about that?
We're planning on the flight being successful.
This isn't just another trip, Neil. You're not just going to work.
Do you think you're coming back?
For the record, I'm not a huge fan of Damien Chazelle. I thought that Whiplash was a fine movie. I didn't think it was the greatest movie ever. I thought that J.K. Simmons certainly deserved an Oscar for it. But the movie itself wasn't the greatest movie ever, although I know some people who think it was. Same thing with La La Land. La La Land had its moments. I thought La La Land was fine. But it certainly, absolutely was not the best of the year. Absolutely was not the best of the year. It certainly wasn't the best directing of the year. Emma Stone was quite good in it. Ryan Gosling was fine. But the Gaga reaction to La La Land was overblown, in my opinion. So, First Man, I'm not coming at it saying, oh, I love this director, I can't wait to see what he does next. I kind of was trepidatious about seeing this film, because I think Chazelle's the kind of guy who can get overblown and overrated very, very fast. He's sort of like a more intimate version of Christopher Nolan, who has a couple good films, but some very mediocre and some kind of terrible films as well. I'm not Neil Armstrong's biographer, so I do not know how accurate this is. But the one thing that I really appreciated about how they made this movie is they approach it differently than everything else. If you want the right stuff, go watch the right stuff. If you want Apollo 13, go watch Apollo 13. There is no shortage of space race movies. There's no shortage of astronauts as heroes. You want the shots of them walking in slow motion down the tarmac? You're going to get that in other movies. You don't need that here. That's not the purpose of this movie. This movie is not to give hero shots. Not to say that they're not heroes. Yes, they're heroes and all. But the point is that this is not fetishizing astronauts. It's showing a very visceral look at what it was like to be one. Now, down in Kennedy Space Center, down in Florida, where I've been, I've sat inside a replica of the Gemini probe. I've sat inside, I barely fit in a Mercury capsule, and the Apollo lunar module. Those things are tiny, and they look like tin cans, and they look like you're inside of an old-fashioned radio. They do not look like spaceships. They look terrifyingly complex, but ready to break any minute. And they are very, very cramped, and the windows aren't very big. Most of the space shots in this movie, and here's where the strength is. The strengths of this movie are when they're doing the NASA stuff, when they're doing the space and the travel and the waiting and the checking and the adapting. That's the great stuff. And what they do is they put you in right there with Armstrong or anybody else. The only way to make this any more intimate into Armstrong is to physically have put the camera inside Ryan Gosling's face. Because he's in there all the time, and all the space shots, you're in the capsule with them. So you see it shaking, you hear the rumbling, and you see the lights flashing, and how confusing it can be, and how cramped it is, and how you have just this tiny little window the size of like a legal pad. Yeah, they have a couple shots that are the grand shots, especially when the Saturn V's going up, the Apollo 13 type shot of, you know, the rocket shooting off and the exhaust and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, you have a couple of those shots. But by and large, this is not shot like a Michael Bay beer commercial. It's shot mostly in the cockpit, in the cabin of these things, in the modules themselves, because that's what the astronauts saw and experienced. And that's the value of this movie, because you get a chance to almost experience what it was like. I've not been a big fan of those like seats that move kind of cinemas. But I think this would be a neat one to be in to watch that way. That's what this film's about. And it really puts you in the moment. And that's the best part of it. And also seeing them kind of going through the gritty, ugly, unappealing elements of training, which you always don't see. It's sort of, even in like The Right Stuff, it was sort of whimsical the way they put it together. Now, the rest of the film, and this is what kind of bloats it into a 2-hour, 20-minute running time, is the home stuff and the emotional stuff with the wife and the kids. Unfortunately, when you come to these space race movies, you have the experience of the wives. Because, you know, it was a sexist nation, certainly back in the 60s and the 50s, women weren't allowed in capsules. They weren't going to send a woman into space back then, because that's the way the world was. So the only job a woman had, aside from a movie like Hidden Figures, where you could take the human computers and make a film out of them, you know, and even then that was extremely sexist attitudes that cobbled those women back in the 60s and 50s. A movie like this, all you can do is have the wife kind of wringing her hands. There's not a whole lot for her to do, because there wasn't a whole lot for the wives to do at all. And Claire Foy is good, and she acts, and she's fine in the movie, but there's not much for her to do. And they have to give her due diligence, so that's, I think, what bloats the movie and makes it a little boring. A lot of the intrapersonal family stuff, to me, that borderlines on just sort of like the misery porn I was talking about with A Star Is Born last year, of, you know, the fighting and him not wanting to deal with it. But it does show the real pragmatic dangers and the real dangers and problems that they were facing, and even just public relation problems that they were facing back in the 60s. So overall, I'm going to say that the movie, it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Now, on to the giant controversy that came out earlier this year, the fact that they didn't have the planting of the American flag on the moon. Again, that's not what the movie's about. True, they do not have that scene. But if you're looking for American flags, you're going to find them everywhere in this movie. They're on uniforms, they're on spacesuits, they're on the side of rocket ships, they're behind astronauts during a press conference. There's even a scene of Neil Armstrong's son raising the flag, and there's a shot of the flag on the moon. What you don't have is you don't have them coming down and planting the flag with a choir behind them singing God Bless America, because that's not what the movie's about. The movie is not about fetishizing the hero worship of the space race. The movie's about what it was like to be there, what you went through to get there, and the danger that you were facing, and the uncertainty, and the claustrophobia, and then the vast isolation that you felt once you get there. Spoiler alert, they make it to the moon. And so when you get to the moon, it's vast and it's isolated. You're the only person for, what, hundreds of thousands of miles. So again, this was manufactured fake outrage. The fact that they didn't have this big heroic moment that wouldn't belong in this movie would have been so out of place. Again, it's not a Michael Bay beer commercial. So don't start criticizing movies if you haven't seen them. Go see the freaking movie and then criticize it as you want to. Damien Chazelle, even though I'm not a big fan of him, he did certainly seem rightfully so gobsmacked when people were complaining about this, because he says that's not what the movie's about, and the flag's in there. Dial back your brittle outrage meters and enjoy a piece of art as a piece of art and understand where the director's coming from. Don't just bang your chest out of false patriotism. So, yeah, go see First Man, but don't look for just the trigger moment, just snowflakes. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to talk about Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, and Bad Times at the El Royale. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween. A group of kids find an unpublished manuscript by R.L. Stine, which opens and brings to life a real Halloween.
Look at this. A mysterious disturbance recently took place in the town of Madison, Delaware. Creatures come alive in the original manuscripts of R.L. Stine.
The book.
What book?
It's a Goosebumps book. It's locked.
Oh, man.
What did you do?
It's time to make Halloween last forever.
This is the sequel, obviously, to Goosebumps, which came out, I think, 3 years ago. Starred Jack Black as a fictionalized version of R.L. Stine, who's, of course, the horror writer who wrote the Goosebumps series and the Fear Street series. He's actually from Columbus, Ohio. although I don't think he wrote any of these in Columbus. I think he moved to New York relatively early in his career, but he's a hometown boy. You know, good old Columbus, Ohio, and its writers. James Thurber and R.L. Stein. There you go. That's who we got. Anyways, I thought the first Goosebumps was kind of fun and cute, and it was at a time where Sony wasn't doing well, because it was right around the time of their big hack, and it was a big hit for Sony. It wasn't a massive movie. You know, it wasn't like what Jumanji ended up turning out to be just last Christmas, but it was a nice little modest hit that did well, and kids liked it, and I thought it was a fun little movie. I thought it was a neat way of, you know, as goofy as it was to have these books open up and shoot things out, I thought it worked for that kind of a story. And surprising that it took so long to do a sequel. I think it's been 3 years, which used to be the standard time that it would take to do a sequel. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, unless you had them in a pipeline like the, you know, real cheapo Friday the 13th movies. Nowadays, usually you can greenlight a sequel. Sometimes they greenlight sequels before the first one even comes out. And then if they don't do well, they just quietly turn off that green light. But this one has Jack Black in it. They actually kept him out of the marketing, from what I understand. And I think that was to avoid any confusion with The House with a Clock in Its Walls. And it also looks like it's shot very similarly from a cinematography standpoint. It's not like one has a very different look. I mean, Haunted Halloween, Goosebumps, looks very much like it was like they just took the same lighting team and cinematographer from one movie to the next. So I understand why they dialed back Jack Black in the trailers. This is mostly about the kids, and it's teenagers in a very sort of safe, you know, Disney or Nickelodeon type of teenager where, you know, it's a very PG movie. And there's nothing terribly unique about the film. It does feel like it's a bit of a retread of the first one because you have the books coming to life. Only instead of it being just the general horror books, it's specifically about Halloween, which I think is actually going to give this one a little bit more legs as we go forward past theatrical release and even past home video. This is the kind of movie like Hocus Pocus, where you're going to see it showing up in kids' television and programming. Like, you know, if Disney, even though it's not a Disney movie, if Disney Channel in the future starts running these multiple Halloween marathons, you might see this movie show up in there as well. Because it's directly related to Halloween. It's a perennial favorite. And it has the horror elements to it. It has jack-o'-lanterns that come to life. It has witches and bats and goblins and ghouls and monsters. And yeah, they're erupting from a book in sort of this CGI flurry of maelstrom madness. But it still has those elements to it. And that's what makes it fun. I took my son, who's 10, and he went with me, I think it must have been when he was 7, to go see the first Goosebumps movie, and he liked that, and he was highly anticipating this movie. He was bugging me about it for the screening for a while, and so I took him to see it, and he liked it. He had a lot of fun doing it. It's, you know, it's nothing unique. That's the thing about this movie I found most interesting, is I remember after I got done watching it, I was like, well, there's nothing that's really, like, lasting impression. It doesn't, like, make me feel like I really need to enumerate on it or think about it much. It didn't have a whole lot of different stuff in it, but it had all the elements you needed. In a way, it's kind of a cliche. It follows the same beats you'd expect in a movie like Hocus Pocus or Ernest Scared Stupid, which I pointed out several weeks ago. Those are essentially the same movie where kids or someone accidentally unleashes something onto a small town and then they have to vanquish it. And that's essentially what's going on here. So it feels like it very much fits in line with those films. And it treats Halloween as a real thing as opposed to a Scooby-Doo mystery where they have to pull the mask off of some evil real estate developer who was going to get away with it if it wasn't for you kids. So ultimately, this is a cute little movie. It's fun. I could honestly see myself watching it with my kids or then later on my grandchildren on a yearly basis, when I like to watch horror movies or horror theme movies in the month of October. So I'm going to have to say Goosebumps 2, Haunted Halloween, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk now about Bad Times at the El Royale. The patrons at an out-of-the-way desert motel are not all that they seem to be.
First time at the El Royale?
You have the option to stay in either California or Nevada.
I always wanted to stay in the honeymoon suite, even though I'm not currently on my honeymoon.
The
This is not a place for a priest, Father. You shouldn't be here.
Are you lost, Father?
Can I confess something to you? I'm not really a priest.
I've done horrible things.
So's everybody.
This is written and directed by Drew Goddard, who did the film Cabin in the Woods, which is, I think, not what he's most known for. I think if you throw his credits out there, he's going to be known as one of the screenwriter for The Martian. But Cabin in the Woods, he directed, which was a deconstruction of the horror genre. And this isn't a horror movie. This is a suspense thriller. It actually feels like kind of one of those indie crime noir thrillers you would have seen in the 90s. You know, something around Pulp Fiction time. Somewhere, if you look at the Quentin Tarantino run between Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, where the maturing happened between those two movies, somewhere in the middle of that is where you'd find Bad Times at the El Royale. Now, it's got a great cast. You've got like John Hamm, you've got Jeff Bridges, you've got Dakota Johnson, who's actually quite good. I've become a big fan of her partly through the 50 Shades of Grey series. As terrible as those films are, I thought Dakota Johnson really held her own in those. So I think she's good in this movie. You got Chris Hemsworth in it. It's a creepy movie because you know bad things are going to happen, partly because it's in the title. But it takes us time to set things up, and it's one of those, it's like a bottle episode of a TV show where most of it takes place in this hotel, and they have flashbacks outside of it. And it's told in that Tarantino structure where it says, we're going to tell this person's backstory, then this person's backstory. Nobody is in there with a story that you would expect, except maybe one person who is sort of the average person coming in, but still has a little bit of skeletons in her closet. But this is it's a slow burn of a movie, and it works quite well in the grand sense. Now, it does run a bit long. It's a 2-hour, 21-minute running time. And I think this would have been served if it would have been about 2 hours, because there are some of the storylines take a little bit too long to delve into. Some of the storylines aren't as interesting as others. And oddly enough, I wanted to know backstory more on some of the storylines, and I got kind of bored with the other storylines. Like, one of the characters is a singer. She's a lounge singer. There's a little bit too much of her singing, a little bit too much featuring her songs, which feels like, I think Goddard's doing that not because he's just sort of trying to heap that onto this actress, but more that's kind of the way these movies were in the 60s and 70s. They had these musical breaks now and then. But I got a little bit tired of hearing her sing. And there are moments, especially in the third act, where it's being played up for suspense, but it does need to move a little bit faster. So it's not a perfect film. And it doesn't 100% hold together. But overall, it's different, and it's creepy, and it's effectively done, and I liked it a lot more than I expected. Even though I expected to like it, I thought this had disaster potential written all over it, and it didn't end up having that. It actually turns out to be a pretty good film, quite enjoyable and interesting and worth checking out. So I'm going to have to say Bad Times at the El Royale kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Colette, the box office, and the home cinema roundup featuring Skyscraper. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's wrap things up with the movie reviews with Colette, which has been in limited release, and it's not going wide, but it's going wider. I think it's in like 400 or 500 more screens this week. Keira Knightley stars as a woman in turn-of-the-century Paris who writes popular literature under her husband's name and wants recognition for herself.
Finally, we have a success, and then you imply that I'm not the true author of it. People love to talk. I understand the mentality here. You don't.
I understand it well enough to write a book that's a toast to Paris.
You've done something important. All those young girls, we've given them a voice. You should own up to it.
He was after you.
Your jealousy is misplaced.
How so?
It was the wife I found interesting.
We're holding dynamite here that could blow our bloody heads off.
Since when have you considered scandal to be a bad thing?
The turn of the century I'm mentioning here is actually the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. So I think it starts somewhere in the 1890s, and it ends, the film ends in the early 1900s. So turn of the century isn't like 20 years ago. It's like 120 years ago. And it's a true story about Colette, this writer who is, she married this man and he went by the name Willie, which was his sort of pen name. And it was a very popular guy, but he got people to ghostwrite his books for him. Now, this is actually not uncommon. Ghostwriting has become less popular now. I mean, nowadays people tend to get credit for it, even if they are clearly writing for somebody else. I mean, the one people most know about, because it's been talked about in the last couple of years, is there's the guy who ghost wrote Trump's book, The Art of the Deal. And you can tell because it says, you know, by Donald Trump, and then in the bottom it'll say with so-and-so. And usually when it's a famous person like that and it says with, that means it's written with somebody actually writing the book, and they're just basically, a lot of times the person just interviews the famous person, and it's their story and how they want the book to be, but it's actually written and penned, and the words are composed by somebody else. This is common. It happens with most people. The difference is, this is more like sort of like V.C. Andrews was a popular writer in the 70s and 80s who wrote like Flowers in the Attic, and she eventually died and they started to write new books. Her estate developed these new books that were from original ideas and stories that V.C. Andrews had had, but other writers wrote them. But it still got credited as V.C. Andrews. And I think maybe somewhere in the copyright page and in the front material, you'll find the real author's name. But back in Paris at this time, this guy Willie, he was known for these books, and he had a whole, you know, gaggle of ghostwriters, but he kind of kept the name for himself. And this is sort of similar connected tissue with something like The Wife, if you've seen that movie. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. That's the one with Glenn Close and Jonathan Pryce. He's getting a Nobel Prize, and it turns out that she actually wrote a bunch of his books for him. It sort of also reminds me of Big Eyes, that movie about Keane, the painter, the woman who painted all the portraits with the big eyes, but then her husband took the credit for it. And so that's a theme that we're seeing showing up in a lot of movies, which happened. People take credit for other people's work all the time. And this is a well-known story if you know French literature. I don't. I've never really known anything about Colette. But this is a true story. It's well-known. She eventually gets her own recognition later on. I think she ends up winning, like, somewhere in the 40s or something, she wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. It's not covered in this movie. But this is a look at the sort of stolen career of a woman by an overpowering man, part of it because of the sexism of the society, but also because of the power structure. Now, it helps to know that going in, because I didn't know anything about Colette or Willie or anything like that, and so I was a little bit confused because they go into this movie expecting you to know what's going on. They throw a lot out at you without actually explaining it. So you kind of hit the ground running. And if you don't know how French literature worked back in the turn of the century, you needed to kind of check the Wikipedia entry first. So it's a little bit hard to get into, but it's well done. It's got some good performances. Keira Knightley's good. And I think she's a little bit, she's a little bit too posh and beautiful and refined for the, she just seems a little too perfect at times for the role. And it does have sort of the naughty elements to it, because apparently Willie and Colette had this sort of somewhat of an open marriage where they slept with men and women. Doesn't matter. You know, I think they kind of did whatever they, it was Paris in the turn of the century. That's kind of what happened. So it deals with a lot of those. It juggles a lot of these issues. And overall, it's well done in that respect. It's still a period piece. It's still a little bit stuffy. It still is cobbled a bit by having to stick with the not terribly always dramatic sequence of events that don't always have the best drama timing in real life, but you got to stay true to the story. I think if you're a fan of these kind of movies, these sort of talky period piece movies, you're going to like it. It was okay for me, so I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's look at the box office for last week. Venom did unprecedentedly well in a lot of ways. $80 million. That is massive. Massive for a superhero movie in October. That's a big win for Sony. I don't know if it's a big win for superhero fans. I don't know if it's a big win for the Spider-Man series or Venom. This may have been something that had a lot of excitement attached to it. It may wane. And of course, they're going to do a sequel. We'll see how well the sequel sustains, because I think we had that same problem with The Amazing Spider-Man. When they made that with Andrew Garfield, It did very well, but then when they made the sequel, it didn't increase in the numbers. It didn't do what the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies did and build upon itself. That's where a lot of these individual movies do well in other studios, but they still have the longevity issue. So we'll see what happens with Venom in the long run. And The Star Is Born came with almost $43 million, which is huge. This week, those are probably going to repeat. I don't know if First Man is going to have the immediate box office. I think that's going to have a lot of legs, though. We're going to keep hearing about First Man all the way through award season. And, of course, you know, Goosebumps and El Royale. I think El Royale is going to struggle a lot more with the box office than some people think. It's just, it's hard to categorize. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time for the home cinema roundup. The spotlight this week is on Skyscraper. Dwayne Johnson stars as the security expert trying to save his family from terrorists when their hotel skyscraper is set ablaze.
Is your family enjoying their stay?
Very much so. They're shocked. You gave us the entire floor.
After your security assessment, what do you think of the building?
The Pearl is the tallest, most advanced building in the world.
You've built a vertical city, but you've brought with it every single safety and security challenge that I could think of. Not only have you brought them all indoors, but you've trapped them 240 floors in the air. No one really knows what would happen if things go wrong.
Daddy! Tell me, how much do you love your family?
It's Die Hard for a modern world, not done as well, but set on fire. Die Hard meets the Towering Inferno. And it has all the elements you'd expect from an action movie with Dwayne Johnson. It totally works. What's funny is there's a weird little story that goes along with this. From my perspective, my mother goes out with her friends from church every Friday most of the time and goes and sees a movie. It's a group of women of an advanced age. I mean, I'm 47. You can do the calculations and figure out about how old my mother is. And a lot of the other women that she goes to from like Bell Choir, they're all around that same age. And they will go see movies. They tend to they'll see like popular movies, but they will go see the character studies a little bit more. I knew a bunch of them wanted to see A Star Is Born the other week. But at one point, they apparently went and saw Skyscraper in the summer. And two of the women walked out. They were so just not offended by it, but just bored by it. They're like, oh, this is awful. Let's leave. And I always found that fascinating because if there's anything, you can say a lot about Skyscraper. You can say it's cliche and it's silly and it's stupid. I mean, it pushes the buttons that it's supposed to push and it works for an action movie. But there's nothing about Skyscraper that doesn't tell you exactly what the movie's about. There are some movies where you may not know exactly what the film is, or the title might be a little misleading and you might find yourself seeing a movie you don't want to see. I don't know how you would go see Skyscraper and not get exactly what you would expect. Look at the poster. It's him jumping from a crane to a skyscraper. It's in the cover box of the Blu-ray. It's him hanging and dangling off a ledge as everything's on fire around him. This is exactly what the movie is promising. And I don't know how my mother's friends from church thought it would be any different. And, you know, why didn't they just not buy the ticket? Why did they say, well, you know, it might be an intimate character study of a family. Oh, it's just a stupid action movie. Oh, well, I guess we're going to leave. Anyways, the Skyscraper I thought was fun. I don't think you need anything more than a good, fun action movie now and then. And I thought that this one works as an escapist film that you can watch on a Friday night. It's totally fine. And if you get the Blu-ray, it has a whole bunch of bonus features like deleted scenes and extended scenes and other behind the scenes stuff. And of course, there's a commentary track as well. So there's plenty of stuff in there to watch and dive into for, you know, a couple hours after watching the movie. And you know, it looks pretty cool on Blu-ray. So I'm going to have to say that Skyscraper still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Other DVDs and Blu-rays out this week include Hotel Transylvania 3 and the Trick or Treat Collector's Edition just in time for Halloween. That is it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Oath and the remake/reboot/sequel of Halloween. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.